Okay.
Marvelous.
All right, brilliant.
Well, let's rock on.
Happy New Year and welcome back to Cider Voice Cause. 2024, the year of the poem, or the year of Perry, or the year of the 13th listener, perhaps. I'm Adam. This is a very rare Lesser Spotted Adam hosting episode, and the last one got lost, so in fact the first Adam hosting episode. Joining me as usual are our table captains / panellists, Albert and Justin. And this year we're going to be putting a particular focus on cider with food, because we loved doing that last year, and we think that cider's place at the table goes massively under-discussed. So, lots of focus on food, and today we're really, really delighted to have a proper food professional with us. So, Fliss Freeborn is the creator and writer of the Jay Rayner-endorsed food site Student Cuisine for the Gloomy Teen, now the Amused Bouche newsletter, a winner of the Fortnum & Mason Cookery Writer Award last year, a Radio 4 Kitchen Cabinet panellist, and author of the brilliant, brilliant Do Yourself a Flavour. So we are incredibly lucky to welcome her to Cider Voice. Hello, Fliss. How are you?
Hi. Thanks so much for having me. What a bunch of accolades. I've never sort of listed them before. So that's a bit mental.
I think you should list them more frequently. I think you should invest in a herald to read them out before you enter a room.
Oh, that would be fantastic, wouldn't it? Just, they could put on voices and do it differently every time.
Get a big like trumpet as well. So you have like, you can have a different like riff sort of place you're going into.
Like Daenerys Targaryen on Game of Thrones with all her titles.
Absolutely, absolutely. That's the vibe.
It gets the point where you've sort of been in the room for 5 minutes waiting for the herald to finish and
roll up.
The food's going cold.
Well, thank you very much for your very warm welcome. It's lovely to be here. This is really exciting. I've never done anything like this before. So, yeah, excited to get stuck in.
Oh, well, we have seldom done anything like this before. So you're in good amateur hands. I guess, first of all, if you could just like introduce yourself and tell us how you got into cooking in general and kind of recipe writing in particular, and then move on to particularly to your book.
So I have always cooked. I've been really lucky that my parents didn't mind me making a massive giant mess in the kitchen from a very, very young age. I was just sort of allowed to do what I liked. And then as sort of family things happened and various things were befallen onto my family, I took over cooking family meals. And so by the time I was 18, I was like completely well-versed in like not just cooking family meals, but cooking for my mates as well. I got to uni and realized that only like one person in my halls could cook anything. And so I spent sort of a long time in the evenings with my mates sort of teaching them, you know, how to fry an onion, how to make bolognese, very, very basic stuff, how to make frittatas. And then people come around and they would eat food. And I've always been a feeder, always fed people. And then people would ask for recipes. And so I would be writing out recipes, you know, two or three times a fortnight. And I was thinking, God, this is getting dull. I'll just write a food blog. How hard can it be? So I set up a WordPress in 2017. And I called it Student Cuisine for the Gloomy Teen because I was a little bit unenamored with my linguistics course. And I was still actually a gloomy teen at that point. It took off from there, really. I took off from there. I actually plugged away at it for 4 years before His Royal Highness Sir Jay Rayner came across it on Twitter. And he sent me an email and he said, why are you doing this for free? You should be writing for a living. And I went, oh, okay. And started pitching newspapers with like funny opinions and stuff. And the one that stuck, you know, actually probably it's a classic Fliss is running before she can walk anecdote. But the one that stuck was for The Guardian. And I pitched a student cookbooks, a really rubbish article. And I basically got so angry about student cookbooks, they just didn't cover anything. And so I wrote this article that really took off, got loads of new followers. People loved the blog. And then a literary agent came across it as well. Both the article and the blog, helped in part by Jay putting it in front of them on an email as well. And then they asked me whether I'd like to write a book. And I said, of course I'd like to write a book, because I have never knowingly said no to an opportunity given to me, for better or worse. And yeah, so a couple of years later, some things happened in those years. I left uni, got a degree, and actually wrote the book. But a couple of years later, as in 2023, I published Do Yourself a Flavour with Evebury, which is a student cookbook with a lot of humour and some very easy, quite fun recipes in there. So that is that in a 3-minute nutshell. Any questions?
Several. Before I jump in, does anyone else have a question?
My one is just an observation, but I was not surprised when you said you were in the middle of a linguistics degree, because Student Cuisine for the Gloomy Teen and Do Yourself a Flavour are both sensational pieces of wordplay.
Oh, thank you. They are absolute
bangers.
So I always joke that the book was actually relatively easy to write. Like, I had such a ball writing the book because I love wordplay. But the thing that was the real difficulty was naming it. Like, it took months to come up with that name. Absolutely months. And it actually came from, you know, pot noodles had those little flavour packets in them.
It said,
do the flavour a favour on it. That was the inspiration for the name. It like came to me in the middle of a dream, like a fever dream. But I stayed up for like 6 months worrying about the name of this cookbook.
To be fair, that's how my dog was named, in the middle of the night with my partner sitting bolt upright saying, hang on, isn't there an apple called Norman?
And it's sometimes Norman's a great name for a dog, unless your dog's called Apple.
I do really like the idea that you were just sat up for 6 months being like, do yourself a recipe, do yourself a meal, nothing of the none of these, do yourself a food. No, this isn't wordplay.
Honestly, yeah. Sometimes when I'm writing, like, I'll stop for maybe 45 minutes on a brain loop of like just going through what will work, and I'll go to Wikipedia and I'll go to like the different sort of idioms from all the different languages and be like, right, what can I swap with that that's got the same assonance, what can I swap with this that will work, oh no, that doesn't work, no, it's not punchy enough. And sometimes like my entire writing process will be interrupted for like hours trying to think of the right metaphor or the right thing. So it's a labor of love, the wordplay, but there we go. It kind of wouldn't be me without it.
There are so many bits in the book that are they're just so much fun. Like, I think, you know, I certainly didn't do linguistics, or the title of my book would be a lot more fun. But having done the English degree as well, I especially loved the was vegetables, but the Geoffrey Chaucer.
In the style of Geoffrey Chaucer, I was inspired to write that. I wrote that actually in 2017 or 2018. Like, it was one of the early blog posts on my blog, and I wrote it after watching Bill Bailey's Chaucer pub sketch poem thing. I don't know if you've seen it. Bill Bailey is like my favorite ever comedian, and I was just like, what if I did that but like about cooking vegetables instead? And I did, and it worked, and people seem to really, really like that. It's very daft.
Yeah, that was the one. As soon as I read it, I sent Justin, I think, a screenshot. My like number of people who will appreciate Chaucer related recipes is a quite sort of slender Venn diagram intersection, but I thought that Justin would be one of them.
Anyone who's technically studied it knows it's not like, it's, I think I put it originally as like Middle English. It's not Middle English. It's not actually Chaucer. It's sort of late Middle English and into early modern, but that's technicalities.
I mean, it would be a bit churlish to be like, hey, I've just put together this massive article like about like vegetables in a sort of vague nod to Chaucer, and somebody being like, wrong phase of the language,
well,
isn't it?
You say that. I did send it to someone that like, I mean, they were a linguistics colleague, and they're a dear friend, but they were just like, actually.
Ash was not in usage at this point. Why are there thorns?
No, exactly. Exactly.
The deep cuts people come here for. That's so cool. But, I mean, I loved that. I mean, I was howling when Adam sent those over. It was awesome.
Oh, good. I'm glad. The publisher actually asked me to add a sort of, They wanted me to put a translation into it, as in into modern English, but I thought that was kind of cheapened it a bit. So I put study notes in the style of like a GCSE sort of revision text.
Should have done medieval marginalia and had little pictures of.
I illustrated most of the book as well. Awesome. I did do the little drawing of the monk on that page holding a very sad broccoli.
For this very audio medium, I have a picture
that
no one of the 13 listeners will be able to appreciate. Which,
yeah, I mean, what is Google?
That's a thing about bits to do with chicken. Anyway, I would have had it, but there are great little pictures through which I didn't actually realize were your own.
The majority of them are mine. Probably 75 to 85% are mine, and then the rest are from my amazing book designer Steph Sparkles. She lives in Australia, so I doubt that she'll be tuning in. But she did the rest, which was great.
How did you find the process of doing the book?
The process of doing the book was up until publication wonderful, and then I realized I genuinely loved writing it. Like I actually wrote it out of the back of a van, going around Europe and Scotland in 2020, mostly 2022. I quit my job to just go traveling and write a book, and that was great fun. But I thought I would enjoy promoting it a lot more than I actually did, because I'm Captain Extrovert, so I'm like, I thought, you know, going to a room full of people and talking about me all the time would be fantastic, but actually I found it incredibly draining having to do that and the social media and like promote myself constantly. Like, so I'm taking a bit of a step back from food writing in 2024 just because it's been like quite an exhausting process to do like the selling of the book as well. So yeah, it's been a bit of a mixed bag really, but like actually writing it, fabulous, loved it.
So obviously the inspiration to write a bunch of recipes has come from talking to like your friends at university, but in terms of actual, you know, things that inspire specific or particular recipes, what sort of things do they tend to be? Is it just, you know, you have a think about, well, oh, here's what's in the kitchen today, I'll make something out of that, or is there something deeper than
it's very deep. It's all the yellow stickers in the reduced sections at supermarkets. I tend to use what I call an anchor ingredient. So if I go into a shop and I see that in the supermarket there's maybe like a duck that's been reduced, it happens occasionally and it's amazing, it's like I thank the Lord when it does, but there's a duck that's going for £3 rather than £7, or there's like a really nice looking piece of meat that's going for a bit cheaper, or even like an unusual vegetable, like a celeriac, they often get reduced, or even like a pot of double cream, like it could be anything. I kind of like, my mind whirs around that a little bit, and I'm thinking, okay, what do I fancy eating? So I do it by first having an anchor ingredient that I know I need to use because it's cheap, and then secondly going, what do I really fancy eating? And a lot of the time it's kind of like light citrusy chili kind of brothy type things. But sometimes it's the complete opposite of that, and I want stodge, and I want sort of lard-based, beef dripping-based, like fat-based, pastry-based things, just to that I want to sit in, basically. So I'll kind of like decide what I've got to use, what I fancy eating, and then go from there. And then I sort of play around with. I have quite a well-stocked. I don't want to say larder because that's posh. I don't actually have a larder. I have cupboards like a normal person. I have a well-stocked kind of pantry type thing. And so I can kind of...
Oh, it's a pantry now, is it?
Yeah, it's a pantry now.
I almost suggested pantry and I was like, that's posh.
What's the difference between a larder and a pantry? Is that a cooling
I don't think
thing?
There is one.
No, maybe a larder's like made of like marble or something.
Marble?
I have neither.
Is it one of them like walk-in?
I think they both are.
Ooh.
My boyfriend's parents have got a pantry / larder. We'll just combine the two for larder or lantry. Yeah, so I have cupboards and they are full of things. Cupboards. So yeah, I tend to have basically I can go to whatever corner of the world I want to because I've got all sorts of pastes and interesting things and ferments and things stocked. I always have lemons. I always have miso. I always have sort of chili crisp, things like that. So yeah. But yes, that's kind of how I do it. And if I need to go and pick up something else from the supermarket, I'm going to do that as well. I've never been one for planning meals. I think planning meals, if I've planned a meal, I can guarantee you I don't want to eat it on the day. I guarantee you.
I know the feeling. You know, you go and you're like, right, I've planned out my meals for the week. I've done all this shop. This thing's going to go off. I need to use it on Monday. And then you come to Monday and you're like, I don't want to eat this. I want to eat the thing for Friday. Shit.
Yep. Yep. One way of getting around that is doing recipe development work for different apps. because then you have to eat what you are doing. But also the bright side of that one is you get your food costs covered. But yeah, no, I can't even remember what the original question was. What was it? How do I get my inspiration? The other thing is I like devour cookbooks in the same way that someone who is addicted to drugs might go into the toilet and snort cocaine. Like I read them cover to cover, like quick inhalation. And my method of like reading them, I'll retain all the information in it and I'll know somewhere in that cookbook, I know that there's a recipe for like feta baked aubergines and I know that it's in that cookbook and I go and look for it. I love using cookbooks. So I have a rather ravishing collection of, I've only got 23, but I
only
use them.
Only a mere drop in the ocean.
A mere drop in the, I mean, honestly, compared to some of the food writers that put their cookbook collections up on Instagram, it's a paltry size. So I flick through them and actually the most used one is The Flavor Thesaurus by Nikki Sengit, which I don't know if you guys have come across as drinks producers. I highly recommend having a look at it because it basically goes into really rich, amazing detail about why which flavors go with what. It's a fantastic book. I can put a link in the chat.
I think that Ben, yes, who was on our last food podcast and is one of my closest friends, owns this book and has highly recommended it to me.
Yeah, it's a bit of a game changer because if you've got two things in your fridge that you don't know whether they go together, say, for example, you've got celery and some lamb sausages, like there might be a section in the book about celery and lamb and like how to use that and whether that goes together. And it's also amazingly written. Like Nikki's a fantastic writer. So that's the one I use mostly alongside my own intuition and my own skintness.
I think, I mean, something with that where there's something joyful, one about a well-written cookbook that you can read like a novel, where you can just open it and just read it cover to cover. There's a real joy to that because I don't have that big a collection of cookery books, but the ones I have I tend to really like. But I also really like it where you read through and you sort of, it almost starts to develop like a thesis or an argument where you're like reading through and you start to understand like, this book isn't about the recipes, that this is what the book is about. I love that.
Have you got any examples of that?
The two ones I always go to are Marcella Hazan's, is it Essentials of Traditional Italian Cooking? You know, the bourgeois
this
cocaine
podcast
one.
Knows it well.
Yeah. Because I never fucking shut up about it. I adore that book. But it's also the No Satay Eating. Is that Fergus?
Fergus Henderson. Yeah.
Yeah. Fergus Henson, because I haven't made all that many from that book, because that's very much one where it's like, this is a quick and easy recipe. It'll take only 10 minutes once you start cooking it. Brine your meat for a month. And I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake, Fergus.
I really want to go and eat at St. John. It's
so good.
I've never been
It's so good. Amazing. Oh, for God's sakes, do it. Do yourself a favor and go. It whips ass. It's so good. But it's such a funny book. I love that book.
Another two I can add to that kind of like narrative storyline is Roast Fig Sugar Snow by Diana Henry. She's got some really good stuff with cider in there as well, which is basically, it's like winter cooking from around the Northern Hemisphere. It's fabulous. Highly recommend that one. It's a re-release. I think it was released in maybe the early 2000s, but I might could get that wrong. But it's just been re-released this in 2023. I've got a fantastic sort of line running through it of just here's how to really make the most of winter. And then another new one by Bea Wilson. I don't know if you've come across her as a food writer. She's like phenomenal. She's like the number one voice in food writing, like factual Amazing. Food writing today. She's written a book called The Secrets of Cooking. It's a big paving slab of a book. It's a big guy. But if you want to know how to sort of do food on the fly and really understand why you're doing what you're doing, as well as eating absolutely delicious stuff, it is a game changer. It's fantastic.
I mean, that sounds amazing. I've had salt, fat, acid, heat sitting on my, I got it. It was a present. I read the first couple of chapters. I read the one about salt. completely changed the way I cook. And then I like put it down, never picked it back up again. It's one of those ones that's now in the to-do list. But
The other three are really good. I've actually lent out, I was looking for my copy the other day. Just wanted to do a refresher on the heat side of things. And heat's not, it's not about chili heat. It's about like the Maillard reaction and browning and how to achieve that if you want to and how to control it. I've given my copy to someone and I can't remember who. Which is really annoying.
Probably done like swaps all the way. And it turns out that Justin's copy, the copy that he's got, was in fact given to him by somebody who was given it by like the person who the person you gave it to lent it to.
It turns out there's actually only one copy in circulation.
I might put a shout out on my Instagram because I really want it back because it's obviously like it's the best cookbook ever.
That's often the mark of a good book is if it's one that you know
a good
ends
book
up kind
or
of
a bad friend
or a bad friend. we won't gloss over any accidental book lending that might have gone on between Justin and Albert within the last week.
Within the last week, oh, that's rectifiable. This was like a year ago, so I am definitely wanting.
My dad gave one of his most prized copies of books. In fact, I think it may have been his copy of Perry Pers, which is not in print anymore, to someone a long time ago and has rued the day ever since because he doesn't remember who and he's never come back.
Oh, no.
I always take a photo if I borrow books from friends so I know where I've... And I put it in my notes on my phone.
That's a good tip. That is a good tip.
Smart.
You're quite good at this. You should. It's almost like this is your job or something.
You should talk about recipes because something that I thought would be really, really fun would be because obviously cooking with wine and indeed cooking with beer are super well known and common and touched on quite a lot in Do Yourself a Flavour. We thought it would be really, really fun to send a bunch of different styles of cider to Fliss and for Fliss to come up with some recipes in which they are cooked. So I sent a bunch of really random notes over with the ciders that we sent Fliss. So we'll go through them one at a time. And from my a distilled version of my rubbish note, Justin or Albert will have to guess what the cider was. And then Fliss shall reveal what it was cooked into. And then maybe they shall suggest something that they might also consider of cooking it into as well. So we'll end up with double the number of recipes. And then we'll be able to write the Cider Voice cookbook, which will sell one copy and go around the world.
Well,
So we have four. I shall start with this one here. And this is a very sparkling dry cider. And it's kind of green apples-y, lemons-y with kind of saline dough and honeyed toastiness kind of flavours. So, Justin, do you have any guesses of what that might have been?
Saline toast. So, can you read it to me again?
So it's kind of green apples and lemons with sort of, you know, dough and toast kind of flavours and lots of fizz.
So I'm going to say that immediately tells me that that's Champagne Method.
I'm trying to make you guess exactly which one
it was. With some lees aging. Beyond that, I don't know. I mean, the bright green apple, I can't really think of what which varietals will immediately conjure
we're getting miles to I'd be amazed if you've been like, oh, green apple, is it? Well, this, you know, with miles too subjective for you to just go, well, this is simply this cider. No, Champagne Method is all we were looking for. You're bang on.
I've got three guesses.
You've got three guesses. Okay.
I'm thinking it's either Gospel Green, Norton Cider Company, or Bollhays.
You are correct with your middle guess, because Fliss is based up in Scotland. So I thought we would include at least one Scottish cider, and we went with the Norton Overture. So shout out to Pete Crawford, who makes fantastic Champagne Method ciders, as he ought to, being one of the foremost champagne experts in the world. So Fliss, how did you find this cider? And can you tell us what you have cooked with it?
I really enjoyed this one, actually. I thought it was really light and like really and so acidic and really refreshing, actually. I was actually expecting it to be like way more barrel-y, but it wasn't at all. It was really clean. So I cooked it into, I made it really shine. I cooked it into a risotto. with loads of did brown butter, mushrooms, and parmesan. But I want, normally when I cook a risotto with those flavors, I want a load of lemon zest and juice in the end to like really cut through it. But I thought the acidity would go really well from this cider, so I popped that into it, and then with a bunch of brown butter in at the end, because Adam on the notes it said sort of toastiness. I thought, okay, well, how can I mirror that within the food? And also, and I toasted the rice as well, and it worked amazingly. I was really impressed with how. I was a little bit worried that it was, because it is light and because it's actually quite subtle, I was worried it would get lost with the sort of, you know, the punchiness of the mushrooms and the sort of the cheese. But actually it was really well balanced, and yeah, we all really enjoyed it. So that was the first one.
So pleased. This is obviously, you know, because I know that you're originally from the West Country, aren't you? So I was thinking, yeah, we can send some ciders over. Surely this will like cider. You're so worried when you sort of send things over. Oh God, you know, will they like these ciders? You know, I have this whenever I open ciders for friends. I'm like, this is, you know, this feels quite niche, but you know, please put preconceptions aside. I really hope you enjoy these. It's a great relief that you enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, I obviously grew up drinking cider. Like, it was the first thing you drink from as a baby. No, I'm joking. But as a, you know, as a teenager, it's the first thing you end up drinking. And then there's like Healy's and Radler and all these sorts of things. So I'm quite used to different varieties, but I've never really been introduced to like the craft world of it. So it was amazingly eye-opening to taste all these ciders and see what I wanted to do with them. And my partner, who is not a cider man, he's a beer man through and through, he was really surprised as well at like how different they all were and how much they just don't taste like what people think cider is.
That is wonderful. That's music to our ears, I think. That's perfect. That's fine. That sounds amazing as well, that risotto.
Yeah.
It's really simple. It's definitely the simplest dish. Definitely the simplest dish of them all.
Simple is very good for me.
The whole bottle of it in a four portion risotto, so this. It better it sort of replace it replaced half the stock, so
Pete Crawford will be horrified.
I know. I did think I opened them, I didn't want to look at how much they cost like RRP, because I would be like, oh, just drink them normally.
he won't be horrified, know, when everyone is buying Norton cider to make this very risotto. That's epic. Yeah, no, simple definitely does me very well. Today I was at the theatre all day today, and when I got home, all I could think to do was like I can't remember the proper name for it, but it's just olive oil and garlic and parsley and pasta and nothing more. And
aglio olio.
Yeah. And I don't know. Sometimes when you make those incredibly simple dishes, it's, I don't know, there's something. I think it's because it's just garlic and carbs and.
Well, I haven't eaten my dinner yet. I tend to eat quite late, I've just sent my boyfriend out to the shops for a 12-pack of fish fingers, and I'm just going to eat that.
Hell yeah.
Adam, I actually had the exact same thought as you. I mean, Fliss's recipe is just fantastic, and I was like, well, I can't do that. But what the idea of using it in kind of using that nice bright acidity you can get in delicious, very sparkling eating apple ciders as a replacement for lemon, as a replacement for that acidity, is great. And then the idea of, you know, just simple lemon and garlic pasta. That's perfect. And actually, me and Becky were talking about this yesterday, saying, oh, we should have that again because we haven't had it for a while. So it's going to happen.
Yeah. Right. Well, we'll do our second cider then. So this one, I would say, is our only non-UK cider. So there's a huge clue there. But it's kind of full-bodied, big orangey, marmalade-y fruit kind of vibes. Medium to medium sweetish, with a bright sparkle, some tannins and sweet spices. Justin, what do you reckon?
I don't know whether to play the man or play the game here. Don't know whether to be like, well, whatever I think it is, it won't be that. I'm going to take a punt and say that this is some kind of Norman Keeve.
Pretty much bang on. Well, yeah.
Hell yeah!
You're just across the border. It's a northern French Keeve, yeah, for sure. If I'm being really picky, then he's just within sight of it. But Albert, do you want to guess at what it is specifically?
Well, the thing is, I don't actually know the geography of my French makers, but I can only assume that you've sent an Antin Marois or a Jeremy Forget, but I could be wrong.
Well, I wish I had access to an Antoine Marois or a Jérôme Forget, it's an Eric Bordelais. It's the Cidre Argelais. So, yes, you're absolutely right, Justin. It's a French Cuv. Fliss, how did you find this one?
This one was probably the most surprising of them. I've tried to think about it and I've tried to write my thoughts down, but I couldn't kind of place my finger onto why. But I really liked its fruitiness. There's a classic kind of, I think when everyone looks at cooking with cider, they go, oh, let's cook pork, because, you know, pork and apples, what, you know, match made in heaven, all the rest of it. So I decided to not do that because everyone knows that anyway. So I did roast chicken legs with a cider, mustard, shallot and garlic reduction. It was like bulked up with cream, and I served it with polenta and spring greens, which I also tossed with a little bit of that cider as well for that kind of body and acidity to like mirror that what was in the chicken. And it worked really well because I thought basically it's quite, nutmeg was in there as well. I thought it was quite a gutsy kind of almost, I don't want to say mulled wine, but it was a really kind of gutsy flavor to it, like really that sort of not really yeasty, but like really full-bodied and orange, and thought this would go really well. So I stuffed the shallots underneath the skin of the chicken, baked it in the oven with the garlic, with the nutmeg, the chicken, and like half of the bottle of the cider, and then I left that rest while I made the after that was cooked. I let that rest, made the sauce, and reduced some more of the cider into it as well, and served it. And we ate it in front of the Top Gear Burma special, which was great. And Lewis was like, this is something else. This is brilliant. And I'm thinking, yeah, this is all right. You know, if I was served this in a restaurant, I think I'd be quite happy. Like, so it went really well, that one. It's probably my favorite of the recipes that I've done so far. it was sort of, I wanted to use something meaty, something a bit punchy, and it worked fantastically.
That sounds incredible.
Yeah.
No notes, I think.
Yeah, no notes, just good.
Stunned silence.
You get like Chinese orange chicken and you get, you know, the citrusy sort of stuff with, I mean, chicken is mostly quite a bland meat, so it can take up that flavour. And the cider really was front and centre. I actually, there was leftovers, so I chopped it into like wraps and sandwiches the next day. And the definite, there was a kind of like barreliness to it when you sort of open the cling film and you're like, oh, that has been cooked in cider. Like, it's not a subtle thing, but it's brilliant. Like, I would 100% make that like 4 or 5 times over.
Endorsement
of my own cooking, obviously.
Yeah. I cooked Christmas dinner this year for 7 of us, and I spent Christmas meal putting my fork and knife down, sitting back being, wow, what a meal. And if you can't do that for your own cooking, then, you know, you're not trying hard enough.
There was a tweet that went viral in 2022. It was like, my love language is making an elaborate meal, telling everyone to get out of the kitchen, putting it on the table and complaining about it. And it's like, that's normally me. Normally I go, this is rubbish, it's too salty, it's rubbish, and no one eat it.
I do that. The main thing I do is that I have too many people round, get way too ambitious, make something that takes several hours, exhaust myself, then sit down grey-faced, like mechanically eat it to get energy again, and then stare at an empty plate and go, I didn't even taste that. Fuck.
I often find if I've been cooking for people, I'm not hungry when I come to sit down because I've been tasting it the whole time. And I'm just like, my mouth is bored of this now. I want something else. but it didn't happen with the chicken, which I sort of, my partner went back for more and then more again and then more.
Nice.
So, amazing.
Oh, yeah.
That's epic. I mean, Normandy cider and chicken is definitely a well-recorded winner. You were talking about chicken Normandy, I think, on our last food episode, Albert. Or was that Ben who was talking about it?
Yeah, I was going to bring up. So we served a three-course dinner at the Yew Tree last March, and our main course was chicken Normandy, which is very similar kind of recipe to what you were talking about. We just didn't have mustard and nutmeg. It was a bit more straightforward.
I really wish I'd had Dijon mustard in the house, but I only had English, so I used less of it because English is obviously a lot stronger. Mm. But I think Dijon, obviously, you know, if you're looking at a French dish, for sure using a French mustard would be better.
Yeah, I think it's a great, really good thing. And what I also enjoy about it is that with chicken, normally it's more of like a casserole style prep for it. So I've got, you can make plenty of the sauce and then freeze the sauce and then use that whenever you buy your chicken, and then you're just easy to.
Well, move on. So that's two winners so far from two. So the third one, we'll do our peri next. Only one peri, unfortunately. But this one is very much the kind of young, ripe, juicy, fruity apricots, kind of melons, and very kind of pear forward style of peri. Again, similar sweetness, I guess, to the Bordelais, if not a little bit more, with decent acidity. Justin, again, I'll give you first guess.
With me having been doing my homework on peri recently, I'm either going to absolutely go mental if I get this right, or end up with a lot of egg on my face. With the idea of lemons and melons and kind of that fruitiness.
Not so much lemons.
What did you say? Melon so and kind of, apricot. Kind of more that was it. Melon and apricot, you said. I'm going to lean towards Hendry Hafkjær?
Oh, you're in exactly the right territory. And that would be... It wasn't a Hendry Hafkjær. It's a bit more niche than that. But you're in exactly the right flavor profile. But there's a little bit more acidity to this one. I think certainly in this vintage. Albert, do you want to?
I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, apricot leaning towards Hendra, but if it's not Hendra and it's got more acid, then I don't know. I mean, maybe more Croft, but
so it is actually Coombe Maddox's most recent vintage of Betty Prosser, which has a little bit more acid than previous vintages. So Betty Prosser, I can't remember whether I put this in the email, Fliss, is a really rare pair. A lot of peri pears are super, super rare, but this is down to, you know, only a dozen trees or so left in Wales. And Coombe Maddox are fantastic producers, really, really great peri makers. And so they've been harvesting from some of these trees for the last few vintages, but it's just a really, like, juicy, approachable.
When you said it was a sweet peri, I was like, this is going to be Coombe Maddox, because they are the best producers of sweet peri in the UK.
But anyway, so that's what it is. Fliss, how did you find this one?
I really liked it. Like, I'm an easy audience, please. But I cracked it open. I was like, God, it feels like almost criminal to cook with this. Like, it was so light and delicate. I was like, but then Adam in his notes said that it would be more suitable for dessert, and I completely agreed. I think the sweetness would overpower most savory stuff, unless you were sort of reducing it and using it really intentionally with like some sort of massive umami hit, but I didn't really want to do that. So I did cook it into a dessert. I thought, because it was such a delicate flavor on itself, I would just add sugar and gelatinize it and make a really sort of fine sparkling peri jelly. But that's kind of cheating in a way. I would definitely do that if I was sort of, and I'd make maybe a cider syllabub to go with it. But in the end, I actually ended up poaching. I've poached pears in it with cardamom and vanilla, and that's it. I toasted the cardamom, just a really good quality vanilla, just a teaspoon. So not very much, because I didn't want the vanilla to be like the main flavor, which it can often be. People think of vanilla as being really, vanilla and really sort of bland, but it's like, it's actually so complex. So I didn't want that to overpower stuff, but it gave what is a really acidic and sweet drink or ingredient now. It gave it like more of a body to it, but you've still got the sort of sweetness and acid coming through, but you've then got it interplaying with kind of floral notes of the cardamom as well, which work really well with the apricot and melon kind of things. And it's just, I'd love to have poached like Williams pears or some other sort of harder pear variety, but all that was available was conference pears, so I went for a slightly underripe version of that. And I've currently got two left. They're poached in syrup, and I reduced it afterwards, I thought that was a good use of them, because it was sort of, let's keep it on the pear theme. Because the thing is, when you cook wine into desserts, and when you sort of do things that are alcoholic, you tend to either be, you tend to lose the flavour of it. If you're cooking a cider into like a cake or a pastry or even a tart tan, you kind of really lose it. So I wanted something with an element that was like the cider, like front and central. So I went for the poached pears. Which is, yeah, it's a bit of a, I mean, it's a classic choice, but I'm pleased with it. It's really good.
That's awesome. Yeah, I love that idea of like heightening the ingredient by, you know, just being like, well, how can we make the most like flavored pear ever, you know, and just kind of building something that like really celebrates that, you know, ingredient in two forms. That's really, really cool. I mean, people are so used to pears poached in wine, so why not poach it in, you know, effectively, you know, in a drink made from itself. That's amazing.
It's a brilliant thing. It's actually, my mum's been giving us poached pears as a treat, poached, well, inside and not peri, just because we have less peri, for a long time. And it's so beautiful to do. So I really like that that's what you chose to do with the belly pros. So it's really build on that pear flavour and keep it, because I totally know what you mean about the, so easy to lose the cider in what you're cooking.
Especially pear. I think especially pear. Pear's such a... It's such a subtle flavour in comparison to something like apple or orange or any other fruit. That yeah, it's really important to pair it with ingredients that work with it and match it and make it sort of like you're eating a pear and you want to know that you're eating a pear. I thought, you know, my initial thought when I do poach pears is to pair them with, like, again, with cinnamon and mace and nutmeg, but like those are far, 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 far too punchy and full bodied for something as light as the peri. And so I thought cardamom with its kind of like almost spicy, piney, medicinal floralness, if I had a little bit of that in there. And I used about 5 pods for the whole thing. Yeah, it was a good balance. Oh, by the way, I was going to say, I sweetened it with a very floral honey from Deeside. So rather than sugar, which is just a bit sort of a one-dimensional sweetness, I did it with honey instead, which definitely worked really well to bring out those sort of like deeper notes.
I think, I mean, honey is something that comes up in tasting notes for sweet peri all the time. And actually, funnily enough, I was literally about to say, I mean, obviously the bottle that I sent you, I think was a new one, the 2022. So it is still really light and delicate at this stage. But at a particular variety, as it ages, it kind of starts taking on an almost poached pear flavor of itself and goes really, really honeyed. So it'd be really interesting to know, you know, just I think it's one of those peris that would kind of think at every stage in its life, it would be incredible with poached pears, but I think it would be something sort of totally different at you know, at whatever age you used it. But that's fantastic.
I think at some point, if I ever get hold of a bottle would get hold of a few bottles and just drink them, you know, as they are meant to be drunk for starters. But I think actually doing it as a fizzy jelly is something I would like to do as well, because like just it makes it really fun. But I actually didn't have enough gelatin leaves. That was the problem.
I have to say, when you said that, I thought, you know, you said, oh, well, I think it'd be a bit of a cop-out. But that sounded incredible to me. I want to try a peri jelly now.
Yeah, I think it would, whenever you freeze or gelatinify or do something with aerate, whenever you do something with the texture, it's really important to get the right balance of sweetness. And obviously the peri is sweet as it is, but if you are serving it as dessert, I think probably a little bit more honey in that or sugar, because it might not set with honey, I'm not sure, would probably be quite good. But I could, yeah, develop that maybe at some point.
We've got one more cider left to do, but before then, you've given us 3 recipes, so I wondered whether Albert or Justin maybe had a recipe they like to do that incorporates cooking some cider or peri.
I've actually, due to various life things, I've actually not done much cooking in a while. I've only just started meaningfully cooking again, at least anything other than absolute kind of basic things. So this might be a little bit rusty. But I was wondering, it's a fairly unimaginative pairing, but I like the idea of what I'd be doing with it. And it's kind of been bodged together out of a number of different other recipes. So I would be doing a pork chop with sage and butter, and then basically pan frying the pork chop with the sage and the butter. Basically just keeping it very simple and deglazing the pan with some fox whelp. Just do a little, just deglaze that, drizzle it over the top and then just sort of jobs are gooden. So keeping it very, very simple, just doing a handful of ingredients and relying on that that kind of acidity and brightness, complemented with the herbal notes of the sage, to cut through the richer kind of pork vibes.
Sounds delicious. I like it.
Yeah, sounds fab. What did you serve it with as sides?
What would I serve it with? I was wondering about maybe a turnip gratin. Like having that kind of... Albert pulling an extraordinary face. But yeah, doing like a kind of gratin turnip to, again, that little bit of like pepperiness you can get from turnip, and then maybe, I don't know, maybe like buttered greens just for, or spinach. There's a lot of like quite sort of autumnal flavors, I think, in this. It's sort of, to me, that this is like an October meal where you want things to taste a little bit like you've just gone for a walk through a field and everything tastes a bit earthy and peppery and like a hedgerow. I don't know.
Epic.
Brown. It tastes of brown.
It's brown. Oh, the best. Yeah. The best food. It's all brown.
Hell yeah.
Albert, before you answer, actually, I've suddenly realised that you're the only person other than myself this week who is drinking a cider along with the podcast. So I'm going to change my question and make things slightly harder for you by saying, firstly, what is the cider that you're drinking? And secondly, what would you use it to cook with?
So I'm drinking Handsome Norman.
Yeah,
because I think of all the ciders that we currently have available, this is the one that best pairs with food. The juiciness in it, the fruitiness in it, the acidity is there, but not overpowering. I think it basically goes with almost any dish, apart from like red meat, but everything else is great for. And it's been probably my favorite cider of the last 4 months since we launched it. So I've been drinking Handsome Norman. How I'd use it in food is hard because I've already kind of used all my trump cards of chicken Normandy. And the one spin-off I was going to do requires a peri because I don't think this would work for it. I mean, the main thing I do is wherever I see a recipe suggest red wine, I just substitute it with cider. And I that's my life. But I don't always get the flavors of it coming through. I made a bolognese yesterday. And you pour in as much cider as you want, it's not going to come through in the bolognese, so it doesn't really work. But since Fliss said that she used an entire bottle of Overture to make the bolognese, I'm starting to think that actually is a business strategy, pivoting towards advocating people buy two bottles, one to drink, one to pour in all their food, is what we're going to focus on in 2024.
I do measure things with like the Italian nonna method, which is like do it until there's enough. And like there was... It took a whole bottle to be like enough. And I thought it was really important to say as well, whenever I'm making like a sauce with anything, whether it's wine, cider, beer, a nice little neat trick I picked up from Keith Floyd was to always reserve like 25 to 50 mil at the end and bring and put it in just raw in its raw form to bring it back up. And like, so you can taste that like proper alcohol again. Totally. So I was always having like a bit of the bottle left. And actually, to be fair, I'd use most of the bottles of cider in everything in that I cooked, but there was probably between 200 and 150 and 200 mil left each time. So obviously those are going with the food, and it was really fab to have the kind of like the difference. Obviously cooking stuff really changes the flavor profiles and what's in it, and they sort of bounce off each other. So to have like this kind of quote unquote raw flavor to compare it to is also really fun each time.
That's epic, and you've earned definite bonus points for mentioning Keith Floyd with Albert.
Our generation, I never saw Keith Floyd in his heyday, but I read Stanley Tucci's book. Becky got it to me for Christmas last year, and he mentions him. And in the book, Stanley says, "Stop what you're doing right now and look him up on YouTube." And I did, and I lost my mind because Keith Floyd is just incredible.
I just honestly, it just the best TV presenter ever. probably complete nightmare in like everyday life. Undisputably probably
unfortunately just a tragic character, but incredible.
Absolutely. Oh, do you know what, I wish I was unhinged and as alcoholic as he was.
He inspired all of our, so at the pub last year my brother and I did five supper clubs beside it. And if I hadn't read the book, and then if I hadn't watched Keith Floyd, I wouldn't have done it, because there's such a love of cooking and such a love for using alcohol in cooking. And because he's in France as well, he does do the ones with cider as well. And it just set me on this path where I was dragging my brother along, saying, we're going to do it, and it's going to be amazing, and we're going to be drinking cider the whole time, and what we cook is going to be authentic, and it's going to be honest, because we're not professional chefs, but we're going to make something fabulous, because there's the love that is going into it. Yeah, it's brilliant. I love it.
It's brilliant. And he's such an inspiration in terms of, like, don't worry if things seem to start going a little bit off the rail. You know, I should use him as more of an inspiration for doing this podcast.
He's the only TV chef / TV presenter that's tried something and gone, oh, this is not very nice. Like the only person in the world that has done that, which I love and admire. And I think more influencers rather than people who cook on the telly rather than just having their eyes roll back in their head upon the first sniff. Like, they should definitely just be more, oh, well, that's not good enough, or like, oh, that's not very nice, or needs more X, Y, Z. But yeah.
Also, it massively humanizes it, doesn't it?
I'm going to start a cookery TV show where every single recipe is a failure.
Oh, that's quite fun.
but I will always go into it with the best intentions and full of hope, and every time I will be disappointed. Any successes will be ruthlessly edited out.
Just a little bit of off, isn't it?
Talking of the YouTube, I think you're gonna have to do a supper club now where all of Fliss's different recipes are incorporated into a U-tree supper, because we've had a few.
Yeah, I mean, we've pretty much got a free course menu, right? Yeah. We could have a cheeky wee starter for Primo.
Yeah.
Chicken for Segundo, and then some lovely poached.
Well, there's a fourth.
Better. So you must get ready, because it's gonna be a banquet. So the notes for the fourth, it's very kind of gummy, kind of jellied, yellow orange fruit with darker kind of barrely tones of leather and spice. Justin, would you like to guess what it is?
Lips touching the mic.
Is it brown snout?
It's brown snout.
As soon as you said jellied, I was like, it's this one.
It's the dry sparkling brown snout.
Yeah.
Which has been the rum cask from Ross on Y, a small, seldom referenced on this podcast cidery.
You shill, Adam.
I know.
In the pocket of Big Ross.
Fliss, so this is Albert's favourite cider and favourite apple, so no pressure. But what? How did you find it, and what did you cook?
This one like made me sit up straight. I was like, holy, this does not taste like any cider that I have had in my life. I'm not that I didn't like it at all, but it was strong and different to what I'd seen, and I was like, God, I don't think I've ever had something that is that much sort of in your face. I am made of an apple. I am a cider. You will drink me. I am made of barrel. And so I thought, right, what's going to stand? I can't be cooking chicken with this. Like, this is, I can't even be cooking cuts of pork that aren't ridiculously fatty. So I actually decided on pairing it with two ingredients that stood up to it massively. You know, it's basically a three-way fight at this point. So I cooked it into mussels and camembert in a sort of with a cream and a parsley, and it worked really well. So yeah, fresh mussels, like glugged in the majority of the bottle, let them steam open in the broth. I fried off about 6 or 7 shallots, just to give the sauce like more body and more umami, because also it would have been sort of slightly floating on top otherwise. Most of the bottle in there, cream after everything's opened, and then fresh parsley, and just serving that with crusty bread. It's probably the simplest recipe I've cooked for a long time, and it only takes 5 minutes. So that was, yeah, really, that's, I know I said the chicken was my favorite, but I think that's been my favorite, and the cider just paired so well with it. Like, it was, I'm so glad I used that one rather than any of the others.
I mean, that sounds amazing. Absolutely fantastic.
You get the little chunks of camembert like melting into it as well, like in the sauce, because it's only been in it 5 minutes, so you don't lose them. They still stay there. And so when you're like sucking the mussels from the shells, you often get little nuggets of camembert that go in there as well. And you're like, okay, well, this is, yeah, I am pleased with this.
I don't know whether we'll have edited out, but my sound cut out completely and I wildly panicked and I missed the beginning of that, came back in, and then every single moment I heard something, I was like, what? What were you like? Oh, yeah, and it's got this and it's got a bit of cream and it only went in for 5 minutes. Like, oh. Then you're like, oh, yeah, and there's a camembert. And I was like, oh. And then you're like, oh, and the mussels. I was like, so that was a really exciting
yeah,
little,
so you got the kind of backwards. Yeah.
Yeah, the surprise meal. I mean, so mussels, what, like just mussels done in brown snout?
Just mussels
with cream
cooked and... in brown snout with camembert melted into it. So you get like a load, and shallots fried off at the beginning. And then a load of double cream and parsley at the end for a tiny bit of freshness, but very not needed because, yeah, that was good.
You'll definitely have to put that on the supper club list for next time.
Yeah, I thought that would be a good. That might be a good starter.
Do the people deserve it? Are they ready for it?
It worked so well, that one, because the cider was like just as far away from sweet as it could have been. I think if it had been sweet, it would have just been a bit sickly, because it is all about, because obviously mulled marinara, which is what it is based on, essentially, is so all about the... it's so all about the broth. Like, you can't really have mussels in a bad broth. It doesn't work. So it essentially was drinkable by the end of it. But yeah, so it was good to use something that didn't have any sweetness there, because I think sweetness often interferes with mussels. Sweetness is really good with other shellfish like scallops or squid. You know, think about sweet chili sauce and think about sort of apple puree with scallops. But actually, I think sweetness can detract quite a lot from mussels, because they are quite, you know, they are quite saline and they're quite punchy and quite savoury on their own.
And the cool thing there as well is that you've got a fish course now as well to go with the starter, main course and dessert. So circle is complete.
Whenever I cook anything, I kind of want one thing to be completely plant-based, one thing to be vegetarian, one thing to have meat, and one thing to be fish. Like, I thrive off diversity of stuff, because else, you know, I just eat chicken every meal.
It's a phenomenal menu. I'm so pleased that you found four like completely different things to do. And also, like, with each one, you know, a totally like different direction. You know, I don't think I like had even a vague idea other than like petit prosser with pudding. Didn't have like at all a idea of where you'd go with any of the four of them, and if I had tried to guess, I'd have been like miles wrong with all four.
What would you have used them in, Adam, do you think?
Oh, geez, I'm not a good enough cook to answer that question. And and the bottle would have disappeared before.
Well, yeah, that was, I mean, I was like drinking them while I was cooking. I was just like, oh, one for me, one for the pot, proper Keith Flood style.
But, exactly.
Yeah. One for me, one for you.
I mean, that last one has been the one that's particularly... Because, like, I think I'd probably done the lazy cop-out and been like, oh, right, well, I can go with pork for like, the Bordelais or something like that. And Norton, I'd probably, like, you know, just... I think just because, you know, it's probably the closest to white wine, I Norton would have been the one where I'd have been like, "Ooh, can I work this in with mulls?" But I think you're right. I think it would be too subtle.
The Norton was also, it was sweet enough to do it, and it was white. Sorry, I was going to say it kind of had a sort of middle of the tongue, sort of almost vermouthy kind of strength to it. I don't know whether that's like right or wrong or whatever, but I thought. Like, it was very, as you say, like closest to white wine. And I usually use white wine in like sort of a creamy white wine sauce or with fish. So I was like, I want to do something a bit different for that. But then I thought, what else do you use white wine in? It's like, oh, risotto. So, and that was a sort of like vegetarian option for the crowd. But, yeah.
How did you find the experience? Because obviously... these were especially the brown snout, but like must be such an interesting challenge, like opening a thing where you don't have any clue what it's going to taste like, and then yeah. like, oh, I've got to work this into a recipe now. Like, how did you find it?
I just sat there, like, in my kitchen. I've got like a big sort of scrubbed oak wooden dining table, and I was sitting there just sniffing it, and then tasting it, and then looking at it, and then sniffing it again, and then sort of going to my spice rack with like the cider still in my mouth, and going and like sniffing along each like different spice, and seeing what, that's a really weird thing to say in a really weird mental picture, but like seeing what I thought would go with it, or like sort of trying to imagine myself like eating a piece of prosciutto, or maybe, you know, trying to imagine what the different flavors would go with it. And also, you know, really drilling down into the actual sort of drink itself and going, okay, is what Adam said on the tasting notes, is it matching up with what I can taste? I there were certain things I couldn't taste in there because I've just, my palate is just not, when it comes to like this sort of thing, it's just not refined enough to do that. And also there's a degree of subjectivity to it, I imagine.
Yeah, a big, big, big degree, 90% degree.
Oh, really? Okay, that is big. So yeah, I kind of had in my head that I wanted to do something a bit different than that was just like the usual, like pork. I think the chicken got set apart by the mustard and sort of that standing up to the sort of oranginess of that one. But yeah, I kind of, it wasn't necessarily a stab in the dark, but it was a sort of, and it was informed guess of what they would go with. And I think the brown snout and the camembert was for me the standout, but also the peri with the cardamom is a second best pairing as well.
Yeah. Well, I think we're all definitely going to go away and probably make in my case, really bad job of trying to cook one of these recipes.
Well, I can send you, I've got they all serve four because I'm actually like incapable of serving the correct number of people for the dish. Like I have to serve like an army. So they all serve four, but I've got all the quantities and I can write out the method if that's useful for you guys to go and have a look.
We would love that. I mean, if you want to do a post on the blog that we share along with when the episode gets published.
Oh, that'd be smashing. Like that. Yeah, I'd love that.
Adam, you asked us to do a recipe contribution ourselves, and Justin has already contributed with his surf mentality entry of pork, sage, and cider.
Surf mentality.
It is pretty basic. That is surf mindset.
And my one though that I cooked in August when we were about to release a cider that I was very excited about and was one of my favourite meals of the year that I've cooked for myself and Becky. Although I'll be honest, she didn't really like it because she's not really into fish, was creamy fish pasta, which is classically cooked with white wine. There's a cider apple called Foxwelp, which is well known to cider fanatics and is starting to filter out there into the world. And it's basically the cider variety with the richest, most vibrant, most punchy acidity and amazing flavors, big on kind of red fruit and just great acid. So using that in a fish dish of kind of any kind, but especially one with the creaminess of a kind of pasta approach to it, is fantastic. And I really love to do it. And if I could have convinced my brother that, again, not being fully trained professional chefs, that it was a good idea to serve a fish course at the supper club, then I would have insisted we did that one. But he said no. So we didn't.
Oh, but that's a shame. I was just thinking, if it's very acidic and sort of, oh, you know, goes as a white wine and even more acidic, so you could do a really good sort of bouillabaisse that's been cooked, you know, with the tomatoes that have been cooked down for hours and hours and hours, and then lift that up with that, because that would go well with the fennel and the celery as well, with that kind of appley-ness to it, really fresh and bright.
That's incredible. I'll have to one of these days, if you're back down in the southwest or the around the three counties, you'll have to come to Ross on Wye and
yeah, look
through
tell
all
them.
These different apples.
Lovely.
Well, Fliss, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us about all this. It's made all the difference to, you know, not just have us offering our kind of enthusiastic amateur takes on what we'd like to eat and what we'd like to cook with, but to actually get these amazing considered recipes from somebody with the background like yours. It's been just a real privilege. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. I've really, really enjoyed the challenge, actually. And I'll go back to cooking those recipes and really incorporating cider into my sort of general repertoire and, considering it just as much as wine, 100%. Yeah, I've learned a lot too. So thanks very, very much for that opportunity.
Listen, it's been fantastic having you on. I think what I'm excited by as well, though, is the way that yourself and your partner Lewis have had the reaction to the ciders, where each of them has surprised you and shown you that the world of cider is so diverse. And that's the message we want to get across, right? The world of food and cooking is so enjoyable to explore through. And the mission for Cider Voice in 2024 is to help propel that story that cider is that. It's the companion to that world. It's another chapter in the book, so to speak. So thank you for coming on.
I'm very glad to have been a part of that. Yeah, totally on board with your mission.
Thanks so much.
Well, thanks so much. Any plugs or anything we want to do, or should we sign off here?
Can someone buy my book? That would be lovely.
Yes, we should absolutely plug it again.
It's available. Do yourself a Flavour is available in all good bookshops and some bad ones too. So yes, wherever you get your books, you can buy Do Yourself a Flavour. Thank you.
So much, and we'll see you. We won't see you. You'll hear us next on the next episode.